Good morning and welcome back to Midpoint Wednesday. I'm your host, Shelley Reback. Today, our primary topic is public education, and we certainly have a lot to discuss with our guest, Jessica Vaughn, Hillsborough County School Board member from District 3 in North and New Tampa, who is currently vice chair of the board. Jessica has been serving on the board for 3 years and is now running for re-election. But before we welcome Jessica to the show, let's review a few interesting news stories from the week that affect us here in the Tampa Bay region. 10 people were arrested from the group of 75 to 100 protesters gathered peacefully in Martin Luther King Jr. Plaza on the USF campus as tear gas was deployed against the protesters by armed police yesterday afternoon. This occurred after law enforcement declared the protest at USF an unlawful assembly. According to multiple news reports, USF leaders said they support peaceful protests on campus, but they called this most recent act a disruption because it involved an attempt to make a permanent Gaza solidarity camp with tents. The university called the tent camp unsanctioned, and a USF spokesperson said, quote, "As the day progressed, police observed participants in person and through social media expressing their intent to use some of the items they brought on campus as weapons and to resist university staff members and law enforcement officers. As a result, USF police determined that the protest was no longer peaceful and participants must leave the area." Close quote. The items referred to were apparently umbrellas and plywood sheets. The university and police said students were warned multiple times not to bring tents, and they were told that they had minutes to dismantle their encampment before tear gas was deployed and the arrests were made. Several reports from the USF police chief claimed that one person arrested was found to have a gun. And of course, late last night, as I was putting together this information, hundreds of police officers in riot gear moved onto the campus of Columbia University, where students and others had also taken over a building and set up a large encampment to demand divestment from Israel. Now, contrast this response with the response of Brown University yesterday, where Brown students took down their tents on campus after the university in Rhode Island agreed to discuss their demands for divestment from support for the Israel military. Students and administrators at Brown made a deal. Demonstrators agreed to dismantle their encampment at Brown, which had been removed by Tuesday evening, and university leaders said that they would discuss and later vote on divesting funds from companies connected to the Israeli military campaign in Gaza. Administrators at Brown said in a statement that it would still hold disciplinary proceedings related to the encampment, which broke the university's rules. Reports of harassment and discrimination will also be investigated, the statement said. Brown University's president, Christina Paxson, said she did not condone the encampment and had been concerned about inflammatory rhetoric, but she also praised the students and said, "I appreciate the sincere efforts on the part of our students to take steps to prevent further escalation." As reported by the Tampa Bay Times, Martin Taylor, a USF senior who observed the events there yesterday but was not involved in the events at USF, said, quote, "Genuinely, politics aside, it was peaceful protests. They were standing there. It's an area that doesn't affect people's ability to get through or around campus. It's not even like a high traffic area for visibility. It's not blocking or preventing access or disrupting studies. It's just crazy." Close quote. Taylor also found it ironic that the other name for the MLK Plaza where protest and arrests took place was Freedom Plaza. All right, clinics, patients, and abortion rights activists in Florida are bracing for the impact of a new law that will transform the state overnight from one with the fewest restrictions for the abortion procedure in the South to a place where it will be all but banned. The 6-week abortion law signed by Governor Ron DeSantis last year and confirmed by the Florida Supreme Court earlier this month now takes effect today. So pro-choice advocates have started getting the word out on how to access abortion pills by mail, because the closest abortion clinic for someone living at Florida's southernmost tip will be a 14-hour drive away in Charlotte. And a patient whose pregnancy has progressed beyond 12 weeks, the point at which North Carolina bans abortion, will have to drive 17 hours to Southern Virginia. So if you are in need of abortion services of one kind or another, or need support paying for an abortion, Progress Florida has information available on their website on how to access an abortion in Florida, and they are at FloridaReproFreedom.org, FloridaReproFreedom.org. Meanwhile, you can take action to restore abortion access by working to get out the vote for yes on 4, which is the abortion amendment, as this November, voters in Florida will have the opportunity to vote yes on the ballot initiative to limit government interference with abortion. And turning to our main topic of the day, education, you'll be appalled to learn that Florida has now fallen to last place in teacher pay in the entire United States, according to the latest report by the National Education Association. Yes, last, number 50. The average teacher salary in Florida is $53,098. While it's $64,461 just across the border in Georgia. The Florida Education Association has called on lawmakers to increase funding by $2.5 billion a year for the next 7 years to address the inadequate pay, to hire more mental health specialists, and to address the academic needs of students. For the 2022-2023 school year, the students enrolled per teacher ratio was already higher than the national average at 20.7 students per teacher in Florida. But estimates show that student enrollment in Florida's public schools will continue to rise. The NEA report estimate that in the 2023-24 school year, the percentage of teachers in Florida's public schools will again decline by 3%, a decline that could worsen the existing teacher and staff shortage. Somehow, the Hillsborough County School Board and other local school boards will have to manage this critical situation affecting our public schools. And to tell us more about the plans for how to do that, I've invited Jessica Vaughn, a school board veteran of 3 years, who is running for re-election to her seat in District 3, representing North Tampa and New Tampa. We have so much to talk about, so I'm very glad to welcome Jessica Vaughn by telephone to Midpoint. So let me bring her on air. Jessica, are you with us?
I am. Good morning, and thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to have you. Just make sure to speak up into the phone, and we'll get right into our discussion. But before we get deep into the interview, let me tell our listeners that while you normally come into the studio when asked, this time you requested a telephone interview because, as you've recently publicized yourself, you've got some health challenges, and having a suppressed immune system sometimes makes public appearances more difficult. But I haven't noticed a big slowdown in your work on the school board. I see you visiting schools throughout your district. I haven't seen a slowdown on your campaign, which is rocking on. So how are you feeling?
I'm feeling okay, better than I expected, but, you know, it's still a challenge whenever you're managing treatment. But I really was careful about the decision and consulted with my doctors, who felt like, you know, we were making wise choices. So overall, I feel good. Thanks for asking.
Okay, great. I'm so happy to hear that. And, you know, I can see that you're keeping up with all of your responsibilities and the activities that you have in connection with your campaign, and of course, we're glad to see that. So, all right, how humiliating is it that Florida is now last in the country in teacher pay? I in preparing for the show, I see that Holly Bullard from the Florida Policy Institute posted on Twitter yesterday that average teacher pay in Florida is now 50th in the nation. So we're last. And while average starting pay is 16th in the nation, she believes that this is intentional and is what's called pay compression, which any MBA will tell you pushes out the seasoned employees in favor of new employees. So Mississippi and Alabama teachers are paid more on average than Florida teachers. So, for example, our first-year teachers make a lot more than theirs, but our 6th, 7th, 8th, and 8th-year teachers make significantly less. So this is a big contributor to the record teacher shortage that we have and the turnover of teachers as soon as they get their legs, like in their third year and beyond, in the teaching career. So research suggests that the push of teacher salary pay compression is what is a primary driver of veteran teacher turnover rather than the pull of other occupations. Do you think that that's accurate, Jessica?
Absolutely. I absolutely think that. And, you know, the past few years, Governor DeSantis has been aggressive in raising starting teacher pay, but it hasn't trickled down or, you know, gone to, like you mentioned, 3 years to veteran teachers. And that's been a challenge this entire time. You know, we've asked for more flexibility in some of the money we got towards the salaries to go to new teacher spending, and that was tricky. And so he's able to, and the state legislation is able to go forward and say, you know, we've given teachers more money than ever, but it's really been our starting teachers. And, you know, our veteran teachers are who we really rely on, especially when we talk about bringing knowledge and experience to some of our marginalized or our Title I schools. Whenever we look at, you know, what do we really need to do to support these schools, it always looks at getting and attracting our veteran teachers. So they have a lot of value.
Yeah, and that makes the teacher shortage more acute, I would imagine, locally. Because if you're an experienced veteran teacher and you see starting teacher salaries going up and you're maybe stagnating, you know, why would you stay? I mean, the teacher salaries in the counties just over the state line, for example, in Georgia, are significantly better. Even teacher salaries from Hillsborough to Pasco are different and better in other counties. So I would imagine that this is one of the reasons why so many teachers in Hillsborough are leaving.
It is, and it's one of the reasons why, unfortunately, and it's been, you know, a hard thing to ask our voters for, why we've had to come back again and talk about a millage and vote to put it on the ballot to give voters that opportunity. I mean, when you mention even Pasco to Hillsborough, it's because they have that millage to add a supplement to not just their starting teachers, but all of their teachers, all the way down the road, to attract and retain and keep our veteran teachers. So, you know, again, if you look at how many counties have had to go out for a millage, whether it's our surrounding counties, and I know we'll get into this, but it always ties back to money, unfortunately, or whether you look at the counties our size and scope, they've all had to go out to millage just to be able to compete with each other at this point.
Well, let's talk about that, but let's back up a little bit and explain to the listeners what you mean when you're talking about the millage. You know, there's been so much news lately about the different different ways that we can address this abysmal teacher pay issue. For example, there was a recent discussion at the county commission about the amount of funding that should go to the school system out of the community investment tax renewal. And I don't think people understand the difference between the community investment tax funding and the proposal to put a ballot referendum or to put a referendum on the ballot to raise the millage of property tax in Hillsborough County to fund teachers. I think there's so much confusion about those two things and whether they overlap, whether they're the same thing, whether they're different. And I hope you can explain that more clearly.
Absolutely.
For our listeners.
Yeah, so we have multiple budgets, but our main two budgets that we have are our general fund, which 80% of our general fund goes to salaries. And then we have our capital outlay budget. And our capital outlay budget is what we build schools with. It's what we maintenance, the actual physical parts of the schools when we talk about broken air conditioning or replacing roofs. So we're talking about turf on field. All of the physical pieces at the school is our capital outlay budget and all of the things that come out of our general fund. And there's different categoricals. It breaks down into different things that come out of the general fund. But a bulk of it, almost all of it, is where we pay our employees from. And so the CIT tax, which was included in with the county commission, that goes directly to our capital outlay. Now, we have an additional sales tax referendum that was approved in 2018 that also goes towards capital outlay. And those are the things that we've been using to fix and update our physical schools. When you see a new marquee or a new air conditioning put into a school. The CIT tax specifically, though, what we've used that for is to help build new schools as the expanded growth in East County has just exploded. I mean, we constantly talk about the expansion, and that's what we've primarily been using to build schools because they're incredibly expensive. That is very different from our general fund, which is where we're asking for the millage and where we're specifically talking about employee salaries. And the millage allows us for 4 years to add an extra property tax to our homeowners. That for that 4 years would allow us to add an extra supplemental salary to our employees. And they see that on their check. It's separate from our pay. It says, you know, this amount, this bonus or however they word it is funded by the millage. And, you know, in 4 years, again, if it passed, we'd have to then go back out and ask for that. But it's supplemental. So they go towards different things. And I know a lot of people would say, well, property taxes have already risen. Why don't you guys have more funds from our property taxes? But what a lot of people don't understand is that several years ago, the Florida legislation put a cap on how much money we can collect for the property taxes to go towards our schools. So all of the money collected from property taxes goes into one big fund, and then they reallocate that to the school district. And if we've raised more than the amount they set, they take that away from our per pupil money that we get for our students.
The pure pupil money that you get from the state is adjusted.
Correct.
Wow.
Even if your property taxes are going up, that doesn't mean the revenue that the school is getting goes up. And that's why it's very confusing to people to say, I see my property taxes are going up. I know that's funding schools. Why are you coming back and asking for an additional property tax?
I think it's so helpful to have that explanation because even I, who keep up with the news, I've been confused by that. So I want to tell our listeners, if you have questions about it, if you have questions or comments about the proposed education referendum, the community investment tax, or school funding and teacher funding in general, this is really your chance to get your questions answered. So we hope that you will give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org or text us at 813-433-0885 and take this opportunity to get the answers that you need so that when you go into the ballot box and vote in November that you understand exactly what this referendum is about for education, because I know that it's been extremely confusing. Well, I want to ask a few more questions myself about this referendum, Jessica.
Yeah.
Like, who's supporting it? Who's against it? And what do you think are the chances of its passing? Because there is so much confusion about the overlap between the CIT tax that people, I think, do not recognize is only allocated toward capital improvements and not toward teacher pay. I'm curious to know, you know, who are the backers of the referendum? Who's lobbying against it? What are the chances of it really passing?
I mean, it's hard to say chances of things passing because things have been so unpredictable, you know, in the past few elections. It's hard to say who's going to get out the vote. You know, I hate to say it comes down to, partisan because school board and education is nonpartisan intentionally. But in general, it does seem, you know, that when you look at it, a lot of the opposition comes from the Republican Party, who, you know, kind of have an underlining value of no new taxes, right? So that kind of makes sense. Other than that, honestly, I haven't seen a huge amount of opposition towards it. I think that people understand a little bit more now that they've seen how much the shortages that we've had, and maybe families have seen their beloved teacher have to, you know, go to Pasco County or lose them to Pinellas. I think people are starting to see in real life the results of not being able to pay our teachers competitive wages. To me, it feels like it has a lot more support this time. I think last time, people didn't have a lot of confidence in our district. You know, it was right past COVID. There was a lot of chaos still happening. There was a huge amount of culture wars happening in our school. You know, I think there was people were still trying to get a feel for this school board and, you know, our superintendent. We have a new superintendent now. Our board works very well together. So in general, I think people have a lot more confidence about our board and to make sure that the money and an understanding of how the money will be distributed. When I go into schools, I get overwhelming support. Like, our employees understand the value of this and they know how much it's needed. So this time, as opposed to 2 years ago, for me, it feels like it's definitely going to pass. People understand it. Obviously, again, the people who are going to be against it are people who are living on fixed incomes, right? This is an incredibly hard time to come to the public just in general and ask for more money when there's so much inflation and all our costs are rising. But when you look at seniors or people who are disabled or people who lived on fixed income, even though it might not seem like a huge amount of money with everything else rising, it's a hard ask to ask people to pay more for home ownership. And even if you're a renter, it might, you know, trickle down to you depending on who your landlord is.
So, yeah, your rent, you know, may go up. Your rent may go up.
It's challenging at this point in time to ask anyone to pay more money. And I wish we didn't have to. I wish education wasn't being, you know, underfunded intentionally in an attempt to privatize education. This is the last thing that we'd want to do. But, you know, I'm passionate about education. I know how much our employees need this. And so I'm always going to advocate for education and for our employees.
Now, you know, you raise another interesting issue about the underfunding. I mean, what else can we expect from the Florida legislature on school funding and teacher pay? Anything good? Anything at all?
I have not seen anything. I will say this year they did raise the per pupil funding that we get. I think it was, and I'm not exactly sure the amount, I think it was like $160 per pupil. But every time they do that, they also erase different categoricals that they were giving us money for. They take that money away. And so we have to use the money that we get for the increase in the per pupil to supplement those categoricals that are taken away. We've just had a workshop on our budget and what the new laws and what the legislation was going to mean. And honestly, it's almost a wash by the time we talk about all the categoricals or unfunded mandates that were added. That $161 per pupil doesn't give us an increase. And so, you know, when we have a fixed income and a fixed budget, and then, you know, we have to give raises to our employees every single year, you know, at some point we have to find an alternative source of revenue, or we're going to, you know, start eating away at the money that we have to save for emergencies. And that's what's happened in the past repeatedly.
Okay. Wow. Well, let me turn to a little bit of a different topic. You're listening to Midpoint on WMNF Community Radio, and we are talking with Jessica Vaughn, school board member in Hillsborough County District 3, about what is happening with local public education. Let us hear from you about it. Give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org or text us at 813-433-0885. Jessica, I've read that Pinellas County recently announced its intention to create some affordable workforce housing for school personnel, for teachers and district employees, in the Mirror Lake District in a historical building. And the Pinellas County Schools will retain ownership of that property through a lease agreement. I wonder, is there any plan to do something similar in Hillsborough County to help teachers and staff of the district afford to live near their workplaces?
I believe so. I know we as a board have talked about it several times. I know that we have a new chief of HR, Dr. Patton, who's phenomenal. And I know recently she's been talking about what that might look like, maybe making an arrangement for our interns if they sign an agreement to work for our school district, specifically in our Title I and our transformation schools, about exchanging it for housing. You know, honestly, on a school district this size, it's a challenge because we have so many employees. I don't know how you differentiate and make sure it's fair, because I'd imagine so many employees would love to take advantage of that. Personally, what I think would have a bigger impact is, you know, I've seen, I think it was Pinellas, I'm not sure, other counties offering childcare for their employees, which, you know, if you have a young child and you're paying child care, sometimes your child care can be more than your mortgage when you look at it. And I think that's a little more reasonable to accommodate more families. So, I mean, we're definitely in talks about what we can do as a district to, you know, provide some relief for our employees when we talk about a livable wage and inflation. So I hope and anticipate seeing something soon.
Well, that's good to know. I guess if you have any ideas for the school board about what they can do to create a more affordable atmosphere in Hillsborough County for our teachers and staff, you should let your school board representatives know that.
Please.
Yeah. Now, turning to a different issue, I've also read that Florida's Bright Futures Scholarship Program for university and college students has been on the decline in recent years. Mm-hmm. And the lawmakers say they're not denying eligible students a scholarship. Economists project that fewer high school students are qualifying for the awards. The reason appears to be that the legislature's long-term decision is to raise the academic standards for qualifying, and so fewer students are meeting those academic standards, and thus fewer students are qualifying and obtaining these Bright Future scholarships. I have an email here from Simon, who says that he notes that many incoming college students are deemed unprepared for the rigor of college-level study, and they're referred to remedial courses. And up to 60, he claims up to 65% of community college students take at least one remedial course within 6 years of their initial enrollment. I guess it's important to note that academic standards will rise again this fall, with students qualifying for the Medallion Scholarships under Bright Futures now required to have a score of 1170 on their SAT verbal and math scores, which is up from the current 1020, and the minimum ACT score test scores will rise from 22 to 26. And students qualifying as academic scholars, which is Bright Futures' top award, will have to produce a 1290 SAT score, up from 1280 this year. And they can also have a, they also would have to have a, an ACT score of 29, which is up from 28. So this fall apparently marks the culmination of a multi-year plan by lawmakers to raise the Bright Futures standards, which once were as low as a 970 SAT score or a 20 ACT score for the Medallion Award. And now, of course, we're talking about 1170 on the SAT, up from 970. On the SAT scores. So this, the impact of these, the, raising these required scores will significantly cut the number of Bright Future scholars, and the total scholarships are projected to drop by 17% in the new year. And that, and so one of the biggest criticisms of Florida's Bright Futures program is that the state spends too much on merit aid, which can go to students in wealthy families as well as poor families, and too little is spent on need-based aid. But certain critics say there's another way of looking at the decline in the Bright Futures program, and it's by assessing the number of incoming university and college freshmen who will qualify for the award versus the overall number of Florida high school graduates. So in 2008, one in three students qualified for some financial aid and the opportunity to go to a better school. But now it's like one in eight students. And so under the current Republican supermajority budget in Tallahassee, only half as many students will be eligible for Bright Futures aid this year as last year. So, you know, that's some of the research that I did in preparing for our discussion. I wonder, you know, if you'd like to speak to that.
Yeah, when I looked at it as well, that's really been the biggest deterrent is the qualifying, specifically with the testing, that's just made it much more challenging for our students to reach the full aid or get the kind of aid that they would need to, if they can't afford it, to take advantage of the program. Another piece that has affected us in Hillsborough County is, again, because we're struggling with our general fund when it comes to salaries. And not just, so our general fund doesn't just allow us to be able to pay more, but it also allows us to provide more units, right, which are teachers or counselors or actual people in our schools. And, you know, since we run on such a tight budget, unfortunately, when Addison Davis came in, one of the things that he cut to allow us to pay our teachers more or hire more remedial teachers was our high school counselors. And aside from that, because they don't make as much as they could in other districts, we have a high number of vacancies. And those are really the people in our schools, because a lot of our recruitment and supporting our students to make sure that they understand and go through the entire process of qualifying for Bright Futures are school-based, but with those counselors, right? They guide our students on their careers post-secondary, whether it's, you know, college or technical school or whatever. And with those large number of vacancies and the actual career counselors being cut at several high schools, that's also affected us here in Hillsborough County. So I think it's definitely the testing requirements statewide that's a challenge. But the fact that, you know, we're not able to provide necessarily the counseling services we need on school sites devoted to making sure the students understand and know what that looks like. I mean, we do a lot and the district supports it, but we really need to make sure that we have those specialized people in our schools that are guiding our students. And honestly, we have high school forums every single year where we meet with our students as school board members and we sit down and we talk. And a lot of them, their biggest frustration is that guidance to help them, you know, go into adult life or navigate what they need to for college, is they really are missing those career counselors. So it's something we've brought up several times to see if we can provide more funding for that or if we can replace those counselors. But again, it's going to come down to the millage and whether or not we have that flexibility in our general fund.
All right. Well, you know, speaking of counselors, after the Parkland shooting, policies were put in place by the legislature to provide greater mental health support for public school kids. So I'd like to ask you, you know, what's been achieved in that regard locally? I know that there was a push in the legislature this year to actually remove some of those policies, which I think failed. So I'm wondering, you know, what have we been able to accomplish with regard to greater mental health support for public school kids?
So we've been able to provide more mobile units in case of emergencies. We've been able to provide more partnerships. The challenge, though, is when they've passed a lot of this support and a lot of the funding, again, there's been a barrier to where we could not use that for salary, which is a challenge. You know, every time we get money allotted to us, there's so many rules around it. And really what we need is, again, we need more mental health counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists. We need more of those in our schools, because right now, a lot of the times, because we don't have enough people, our mental health teams get pulled for other things in the school where they need to help with testing. I mean, there's so much standardized testing and testing happening that's state mandated. And so it was actually part of our legislative platform this year to allow that funding that comes down for mental health allocation from the state to have the flexibility to be used for salaries. And from what I understand from our legislative aide, the legislation with their dereg bill did a lot for us to start using that mental health funding for salaries in our schools. However, the Department of Education has not changed their rule to match the new legislation that would allow us to do that. And that's where the hiccup is right now. So from what I understand, they're going to create or allow maybe what they're working on is a few schools to use that funding towards salaries to see if that really has an impact or not. And then they'll look at changing their rules. That's what I've heard on the last update from that.
Oh, so once again, this is sort of the limitations are a function of the state rules that don't allow the district sufficient flexibility in the funding that is provided to put that funding where it apparently needs to be. I mean, So it's another example of the legislature really preempting local control on an issue that's very much of concern to local residents. It's another example of their push for preemption, you know, whether it's we can't have a tree ordinance or we can't ban plastic straws or single-use plastic bags. This is another example that maybe is not necessarily seen as preemption as much as it is education policy, but it is, in fact, it's a preemption measure.
Absolutely. I mean, school boards were the first place that they started eroding home rule. Whether you want to tie that back to, you know, the attempt to privatize that's been in the works from the state for, you know, many decades. But we were the first kind of trial period and home rule is, you know, that ability for local jurisdictions to make their own laws and rules to govern their own, you know, municipalities, because our municipality is very different than a smaller county somewhere else that's very different. So we should have some flexibility to represent our district and, you know, the people who voted us into office. But we have very little flexibility. I mean, we have very little home rule left when it comes to school boards. And every day that gets eroded more, unless you're talking about book challenges. And then for some reason, you know,
that was going to be my next question. Can we talk about book challenges, book banning, and what is happening or not happening at the Hillsborough County School Board on that issue?
Yeah, so we've had three full book challenges, one last March, and we just had one on Tuesday. And again, it's interesting to me that, you know, we've had so much of our ability to make decisions, whether it comes to funding or rules within our schools, teaching certain contexts such as Black history, or has been taken away from us locally. But for whatever reason, the state legislation has decided that we have to overstep our media specialist or overstep several committees put in place to make decisions about books. And we have to be the final say about whether a book stays or goes in our school, which I think is very interesting. But so far, out of all three of the challenges, the very first book was challenged in middle school, and the board decided to remove it all out of middle school. Out of all middle schools, it was This Book is Gay. That was not a unanimous decision. It was 3-4 who decided to remove it. And we had two book challenges in our high school that were on Monday, and the board voted 5-2 to uphold the two previous committees' decisions, because when a book is challenged, the very first thing that happens is the librarian reviews the book to see if it was appropriate. The librarian decides to keep it. The next thing they do is they, before the school year even starts, they get a committee together, a local school committee made up of teachers, parents, PTA, students, where in case a book is challenged, that committee reads the book. They have a discussion about it based on the merits of the challenge, and then they vote whether or not to keep it in their own school. So that district committee votes. If then again the person who challenged the book isn't happy with that, they can challenge it up to the district level, where we have a committee of, you know, whoever sees the media, oversees the entire media, all the media specialists, all of the district personnel in academic services. Again, we have a PTA member. We have lots of different members on that committee. They read the book in its entirety. They discuss it, and they decide whether they think we should keep it in our libraries. And then if the person who challenges it isn't happy with that, it finally comes to the school board. And so a majority of us decided to uphold the two previous committees before us, that almost all of them voted unanimously to keep the books in our libraries. One member at the district committee voted to send it back to the school committee because they had more questions, but almost unanimously for both books. And so the school board decided to uphold our committees and keep the books in our schools.
And these committees, are they volunteer committees that, you know, members of the public can serve on? How are they chosen?
They are volunteer committees. They've gotten more challenging to fill because part of the legislation in the book challenges where now these committees are open to the public, and there are a lot of people who are worried that they'll be doxxed or comments will be taken out of context, or a lot of times people who, you know, want these books removed will come to these committees and privately film what people are saying. And so it's gotten harder and harder to staff these committees, but luckily we've been able to. And I think they did a really great job. It's very thorough. They really discuss it. They talk about all the things that they might be concerned about. They talk about the law. They really, you know, they're very thoughtful discussions. Because these are hard topics. Some of these books are very heavy, you know, and some of them do have sexually explicit content in it. And, you know, some of this is subjective. The main point, though, is at any time, any parent who does not want their children to read any book in our library makes one call to the librarian, and they can make sure that their child is not able to check out anything that they're not comfortable with. It doesn't even have to be a book. It could be certain content they just don't want their children to be able to check out. So, you know, we have a lot of flexibility where parents can definitely, if they're involved, make sure their children are only have access to things that they approve.
So that's already in place, the procedure that if a parent doesn't want their children to have access to any particular materials, books or otherwise, they can contact the school librarian, make their position known, and the school librarian in every school in the district will enforce that on behalf of that parent. Is that right?
Absolutely, 100%.
So that already exists.
Yes. Not even just library books. If there's certain curriculum you don't want your child exposed to, if there's certain materials you don't want your children exposed to, you can contact the teacher, you can let it be known through the principal, and you can opt out of that. I mean, that is the fundamental basis of the parental rights bill.
So that is out there for parents who are concerned about particular materials their children may have access to. That's out there in the public schools already. And so it's interesting to me that these book ban challenges seek to ban these books. First of all, they seek to ban them throughout the district, but really this process that you're describing is a school-by-school process. It's not geared toward the entire district, because different schools may have different communities with different ideas about what's appropriate or not appropriate, right? So when you take up a book challenge, it's supposed to be anyway on a school by school basis, right?
Correct. Everything that we do when it comes to decision making, we try to keep it as local and school based as possible, because as you mentioned, so many communities are different. I mean, you look at when we changed the mask, we changed the mascot at Chamberlain a few years ago. You know, we gave equal opportunity to two different schools. One school voted with their students and their the employees overwhelmingly to change it, and one school didn't. And we upheld that because one thing that Hillsborough has been committed to specifically is allowing each individual school community to make decisions for itself, to prioritize what's important for that community, and to be, you know, semi-autonomous. I think that's very important because our communities are all so different.
Hmm. Okay, I have a call here from Travis in St. Pete I'm going to take. Travis, you're on the air with Jessica Vaughn, school board member from District 3 in Hillsborough County.
Hi, good morning. This is Travis from St. Pete. And I've enjoyed the tie. I enjoyed the talk. I have a brother who's a longtime teacher in Hillsborough County, and I have a sister who was a longtime teacher in Hillsborough County, but she and her husband had to move to Georgia, and she teaches in the Georgia public schools now. But so it is an interesting look at the two different systems when you were talking about pay. They're both seasoned mm-hmm. teachers and stuff.
Right.
But I have a question about the book banning and whatnot. As far as I might be mistaken, but the committee that looks at the books, I think someone had mentioned it's a volunteer committee. of, is it community residents? And how do they get on the committee, and what are the qualifications?
Great question, Travis. Thanks for asking it. Jessica,
sure.
Can you explain that process?
I can, from my understanding. Now, again, our media specialists are the ones who put together from a committee. But from my understanding, at the beginning of the year, you get a huge packet of stuff when you're a parent these days to take home. But there's an open call if you're interested in being on a committee to say, hey, we're going to put our library committee today. If you're interested, please give us a call. Turn in this form or submit it. And then if people are interested, they can. Again, there are some spots that are always held to make sure that there's a member from the PTA on. We always hold a spot for students. They get, you know, preferential in case we want as many student voices on the committee as possible. And so then from then the librarian, you know, goes through that list of qualified people. Sometimes there's not enough people. Sometimes they might send out a second request because, again, these have been very hard to staff since they've become so open to the public, and because people feel that there might be bad actors who come and take things out of context, or that they'll get doxxed, or that they'll get negative feedback because of it. It's been such a controversial process. And then forms the committee from there. So as far as my understanding of the qualifications, you just have to be a community member in that school, either a parent, a student. I don't believe it's open till non-parents, but I can double check that and ask that, because that's a good question.
Yeah, in fact, the book challenges that have been made around the state, we've read that many of these book challenges are being made by people who have no connection to the school at all. They're just, you know, people in that county. And as a result, the governor has now reined in the ability of people unconnected with the school to make book challenges, and has, sought legislation that would limit outsiders' book challenges to one a month, as opposed to, you know, a parent who would have more freedom to make more book challenges if they have a child in the school. So have we been seeing these book challenges from outsiders, people unaffiliated with the schools in Hillsborough County, or have they been, you know, school community members?
So that's a great question. Out of the two books, one was initiated by a parent in the school. The second book was initiated by someone who did not have children in our public school. Since that legislation has passed, the active date of that legislation that limits people who don't have children in our schools to one book challenge a month, since that has passed, there is one group specifically, I believe it's called Defending Democracy, who do not have children in our school system. Since they're worried about that law, after that law was passed by legislation, they put in, I think, 40 book challenges in the last month to try to kind of get these challenges through the system before that law takes effect.
Oh, interesting. So now the school system has to go through those 40 challenges before the law takes effect, because they were put in place before the effective date of the legislation that limited the challenges.
Correct. And that's a lengthy process. I could talk about the amount of resources that takes away from our district that would provide support to our schools, and, you know, what a barrier that is, especially right now. The problem is the person who put in the challenge, the first process of the challenge, before you can officially challenge it, you need to reach out to the school librarian and the principal directly. And these challenges bypass that step. So I know we've contacted the person and asked them to follow the first step so we can move the challenge along, and that hasn't been done yet. So right now it's still in limbo, but if that piece of it is met, we will have to hear those challenges regardless, because it was initiated before the law takes effect.
Okay, and the last question we have time for you, Jessica, is there's been a push to try to make school board positions partisan positions as opposed to nonpartisan positions as they are now. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that it's important for education to remain nonpartisan. You know, even though we all have our party affiliations, I work very closely with all sides of the school board, and you'd be surprised, you know, it, a lot of votes go down party lines, but some don't, especially the ones that have a direct impact on our students. And so I think that, you know, adding more partisanship into education is dangerous and unneeded. So, you know, I don't think that's of value. And I'm surprised it hasn't passed. You know, I'm disappointed that our term limits were reduced because it is such a huge job that you have to learn so much. I think that limiting school board members to 8 years as opposed to the 12-year term limit they put on is a disservice. But I think adding more partisan politics in school boards and education does a disservice to our schools and our students, because at the end of the day, education shouldn't be about, you know, your party affiliation.
Well, in fact, you've been by name, you know, attacked by our governor, and, you know, he's spoken out against you and another Hillsborough County School Board member, Nadia Combs, and targeted you both for to lose your elections and to be replaced by people affiliated with his party, with Republicans. You know, how do you react to that?
It's disappointing. It's disappointing, you know, to see our governor try to put his finger. I mean, and the fact that he called it a target list specifically feels very hostile.
Yeah.
You know,
like Nixon's enemies list.
I mean, a target list to me has a, you know, almost like a, you would go at a gun range, you know. I mean, it seems very aggressive in nature. It's disappointing. I think that both Member Combs and I have been phenomenal school board members who work really hard to get into our communities, to be thoughtful about the choices that we make. I have lots of support in my district that comes from all sides, independents, Republicans, Democrats, because honestly, at the end of the day, you know, what people want value is somebody who's willing to show up, do the hard work, you know, make sure that they're accessible, that they're responsive, and that it shouldn't matter what you have next to your name or how you vote or your partisanship. So to me, it's disappointing, you know, that it's become this extreme, but you know, I'm confident that that's not going to have a real big effect on my election because, again, I spend so much time in my community. They know me. They know what I stand for and the work that I do. So, you know, I'm confident in that effect. Hopefully not too confident, but we'll see on election day what that looks like.
All right. And you seem to have a cordial relationship with everybody on the board, regardless of party affiliation. And, you know, there does seem to be sort of a, you know, all for one atmosphere on most of the issues that directly affect students. And I think that that's something that, you know, people should consider when they, you know, again, when they go in November and they cast their ballot, you know, they should look at things like that. They should look at how the board is functioning. It seems to be a more collegial group of members now than in the past, at least to me as an outsider looking at it just from the news.
We have worked very hard to make sure that we're as high functioning and as focused on, you know, student achievement, supporting our employees, making very responsible budget decisions, because that's something we talk about a lot. I feel very lucky that I serve with the members that I do, regardless of what partisanship that they have.
All right. I'm sorry. I've got to cut you off now because this
worries.
Is the end of the show. But I really want to thank you, Jessica Vaughn, who soldiered up and joined us by telephone today to fill us in on what is happening with public education locally. Jessica is serving on the school board as the member from District 3, which is North and New Tampa. So if you have questions that we didn't get to today, reach out to Jessica either through her office at the district or her campaign, which you can find at votejessicavaughn.com. Thanks also to our WMNF operations volunteers, Jessica Green and Barbara Fling, and to all of you who stick with us on Midpoint week after week. We really appreciate you. Now stay tuned for Talking Animals after the NPR News. We are your independent, non-commercial, listener-supported community radio. We are WMNF Tampa.
The heat wave is on its way, and we don't mean the Florida weather. WMNF's Tropical Heat Wave is back at the Cuban Club in Ybor on Saturday, May 4th. You'll see an eclectic mix of national and local bands, like The Record Company, Grammy-nominated and Blues Music Award winner Ruthie Foster, Say She She, the Dolly Rots, plus Eddie Ninevolt, Selwyn Birchwood, Sweeping Promises, and more. We have a few things up our sleeves, too, like local food and art vendors, refillable water bottle stations for a greener experience, and cool swag, all while celebrating with your WMNF community. Don't miss WMNF's Tropical Heat Wave, May 4th at the Cuban Club in Ybor. See the full lineup and buy tickets at tropicalheatwave.org. Those that got the answers.